Hello, I'm Jim Ausman. I'd like to introduce this session on glioblastoma and gliomas. How should we treat them? Brain tumors are about 1 to 2% of all tumors in the body. Metastases, about 1 out of every 4 patients with cancer has a metastasis to the brain. So they're the most common brain tumor. It's a secondary brain tumor. But of the primary brain tumors, gliomas represent about 30%. Of those, about 80% of those are glioblastomas, and 25% of primary brain tumors are meningiomas. There are other tumors too. It's craniopharyngioma, medulloblastoma, acoustic neuroma. We're going to talk about those tumors in another session at this meeting. So the real problem is, what do I do? How do I do the best thing I can do for my patient? Well, what do we know? From the data we know, if we do the best resection we can, and then we go ahead and treat the patient with radiation therapy, about 1 out of 10 will survive 2 years, 10% 2 year survival. If we give them a chemotherapeutic agent, a drug called temozolomide, the survival goes up to 25% at 2 years. That's significant. So that leaves us with the question of, is what are these other things that are being done, and are they going to be valuable? And are they going to make a significant effect on the long-term survival, and that's quality of survival? Well, a couple of things have been done. One, they find a study's been done to show that the more tumor you resect, the longer you'll have of survival. So that's led to brain mapping and detailed work on trying to find ways to resect the most amount of tumor you can. Cleopatra Charlemagne-Palki is going to talk about that. She's from Germany, has done a lot of work on that. She looks at the fluorescence in the tumor. They inject a dye that fluoresces during the operation, so you see the margins of the tumor. They look at the MR, they look at fiber tract imaging, use neuronavigation, which has probably been programmed with all that, and at the end uses ultrasound to make sure they got everything out. The real question is, we know that glioblastomas extend beyond the local area. About 30% of them are localized. So how do we get to that part of the tumor? And so other things have been done. Immunotherapy, Linda Liao, who's had a neurosurgery at UCLA, has worked on immunotherapy for tumors. And that is in an effort to try to get to the tumor that's beyond what we see on the MR. Dr. Puttavalli, who is the head of neuro-oncology at MD Anderson in the United States, we'll talk about the work they're doing looking at the genetic analysis of a tumor and trying to find what abnormal genes they have, because if they find some that are in a certain pattern, that tumor might be more sensitive to chemotherapy. And for example, oligodendroglioma is one of those tumors. Dr. Ian Lee is also a neurosurgeon at the Hermelin Brain Tumor Center at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, and he'll comment on their experience. So what we should learn from these people is, what do I do with a glioblastoma, no matter what country I'm in? Everybody doesn't have all this advanced technology. Does it make a difference? Is it going to make an increased, meaningful quality of life survival to people? That's what you want to know. Or not. You still have the standard treatment, which is resection, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy. But there are things that you can use in your location that will allow you to do a better job for your patient. So they're going to show a case of a glioblastoma, and they're going to talk about this. Then they're going to show a second case of a low-grade glioma, or appeared to be a low-grade glioma, certainly by imaging, that extends from the frontal lobe down to the brainstem. Well, you can't resect that lesion. But the most important thing to do is to get a generous tissue sample so that you can determine exactly what kind of a tumor it is. And then there may be some chemotherapy, as in oligodendrogliomas, that may be helpful. And they'll present that case and talk about that. Ather Enum is the moderator of this session. He's from Aga Khan University in Karachi, and he has an assistant, Ashan Ali Khan, who works with him at the same university. So that's the faculty, comes from around the world, and you'll see how they think about these cases. These are cases you see, and you and I are troubled by them. How do I do, how can I do the very best I can for my patient? That's what you want to know, and see what you learn from them. So we appreciate your coming, hope it's worthwhile. Thank you very much.
So we can start with our first case. So 63-year-old gentleman came with the complaints of expressive dysphagia, irritability, and behavioral changes for 2 months. On examination, he was ataxic, and there was white left ventrion, repetitive aphasia, and expressive aphasia. So the pre-op MRI done in September 2017 showed left parietal lesion. And can you please go to the next slide, Mike, please? So
sure.
There are many images. We'll just go.
Okay.
So after T1, you can see the lesion in the left parietal lobe. Next one, please. Okay. So here's the T1 post contrast, and you can see the lesion in the left parietal lobe, and then it's extending medially to the ipsilateral occipital horn as well. Next, please. So the next image, yes, so here we have the sagittal, the T1 post contrast. You can see the extension of the lesion. Next one, please. Then we have T2 and the flare images. Okay, the T2 you can see, and then we go to the flare. Mike, you can just go to the flare one, please. We are limited by the time, we just want you to observe. Right, so the coronal flare. And next one, please. So he underwent neuronavigation guided awake craniotomy, and we did the excision of the left parietal space occupying lesion. And intraoperatively, the tumor was adherent to the eloquent area, and especially the medial part of the tumor. And we were able to do maximum safe resection in this. And histopathology came the GPM glioblastoma W to grade 4. And as you can see, the post-op MRI showed some abnormal enhancement along the medial margin of the left parietal resection cavity. Just please, the next images, we can see the post-op. It's the T1 and the next one, T1 post-contrast. Yeah, thanks. So there was minimal, you know, you can see on the medial margin that we thought could be the residual disease. The next one, please. Okay. And next, please. T2 and C. And the last one, last image of this case, please. Okay. So, Dr. Arthur is supposed to be the moderator here, but I think we can start the discussion like how. You will do it. Will you have a different approach? And you know, the different things, like the important question that would be whether we will do awake or we will do asleep, and what other factors you would think in this patient. And this gentleman was 63 year old. What if he would have 73, 75? These questions that we would like to, you know, discuss with the panel.
Okay.
So we can start with Dr. Cleopatra, if you would like to share your thoughts.
So I am a neurosurgeon in Germany. I am practicing 26 years in different universities. I start in Mainz with Professor Pernetsky, and then I move in Austria, and now I am currently in Cologne. Since 8 years, I am professor of neurosurgery, and I am very specialized in brain tumor surgery, and especially in glioma surgery. And as you know, we use here standard case since 12, 13 years now, the so-called 5-aminolipulin acids for treating gliomas. So we use fluorescent techniques. Especially in this case, we would also do an awake craniotomy because it's on the left side, it's on very eloquent areas, it's on the speech area, it's on the motor cortex area. So it's high eloquent. And in addition, we would use here 5-ALA because it's very, very common for gliomas. You have a nice gross total resection. So I think this is the only addition what we would make more here in Germany than this one you did. So we are very familiar here with fluorescent techniques. And another thing is, of course, electrophysiology. Electrophysiology, but if you do awake craniotomy, then I think in every department, automatically, you do also electrophysiology. What you hear, I think you did mention it, but you perform this, right?
Electrophysiology.
And then neuro navigation, yes, it's a very good thing, but the big thing if you use neuro navigation is for prepare exactly the craniotomy. So if you go into the tumor, then in such a tumor, you have such a big brain shift that you cannot follow the neural navigation for checking exactly the margins. And I think over there, if you have a real-time fluorescent technique, it's additional advantage. Another thing what we use here, we use ultrasound in combination with neuro navigation. We try to fix this problem with a brain shift at the end of the surgery with higher resolution ultrasound technique. So this is what we do here in Germany as a standard.
Okay, thank you for hearing. Yeah. Dr. Vinay, would you like to add?
Thank you. I think Dr. Chalampaki covered nearly all of the important factors here. I think handedness and language function, the location of the critical functional structures around this tumor are crucial in terms of making those decisions. And I think the surgeons on the team here would agree. I'm a neurologist, neuro-oncologist, do the medical therapy of this after resection. But of course, we interact very closely with our neurosurgeons. I think functional mapping prior to surgery, and our institution also uses, in the right cases, intraoperative MRI scans to further define the extent of resection, as Dr. Chalampaki mentioned. Gross total resection is the goal, but if that's not feasible, maximum safe resection would be the next goal. Dr. Sawaya was the former chair of neurosurgery here at MD Anderson Cancer Center, where I currently am. I was one of the first to show that the extent of resection, the more tumor you are able to get out, the better the survival. And that has then been brought into the modern data sets through efforts from UCSF, UCLA. So I think it's fairly well accepted that if you can get maximal safe resection and get as much of a resection as possible, that mm-hmm. certainly helps at the other end. We can discuss the chemo and the radiation part shortly, but I know there are other surgeons on the call. They have other opinions.
Ask Dr. Lynn Dalyu if she would like to add.
Yes. Hi, I'm Linda Liao. I'm a neurosurgeon at UCLA. I'm chair of the department here at UCLA, and I've been here pretty much 25 or more years now. I think I agree with everything that has been said in terms of the resection. Here we do functional MRI as well as DTI tractography prior to surgery, and that's really kind of how we determine whether or not to do these surgeries awake or not. So if the fMRI shows that the lesion is within a centimeter of functional language of areas, that's how usually determine whether or not we would do this awake. And of course, handedness and a lot of other neurocognitive and speech testing is would be useful to determine what actually we map when we do the awake craniotomies. Other than that, I think everything else has been said quite well. I agree with the neuronavigation, the intraop, electrocorticography and motor strip mapping. Usefulness of extent of resection, the goal is really to maximal safe resection. In this particular case, I probably would also do subcortical mapping, because I think the concern is not really the cortical language areas, because it's pretty superior to that, but it's really the subcortical areas deeper down. And then as far as resection, I think I probably would also, if safe, resect the non-enhancing areas of tumor, because it does look like there are some residual non-enhancing areas of tumor as well. But other than that, I agree with everything else that's been said.
I guess I'm up next. My name is Ian Lee. I'm a neurosurgeon at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, co-director of the Brain Tumor Center, along with Dr. Walbert, who I think Dr. Puttavalli knows pretty well. So I don't want to echo everybody else has said. I agree with everything that everybody else has said. I think Dr. Liao probably has better functional mapping or functional imaging than I have. At least at our facility, our fMRIs, I think, are pretty good for lateralization, but not so good for localization. So especially for the receptive speech area, I think I would still probably do it awake regardless of the functional imaging, unless it very clearly showed that lateralization was on the other hemisphere, which you wouldn't expect for a right-handed person. I think, our practice here has been mainly to use the intraoperative MRI. That's mainly because Gleolan is a relatively recent addition to our armamentarium, although certainly we've started to incorporate Gleolan more into our glioma surgeries. I think the one thing that has changed, other than with Gleolan, the other thing that has changed for me in the last probably 5 or 6 years is that I moved away from bipolar stimulation and moved more to monopolar stimulation, especially for subcortical stimulation for motor and speech mapping. And one of the really nice things about monopolar stimulation, in addition to probably a lower risk of seizure, is the fact that you can, they have these sucker monopolar stimulators now, so that you can stimulate and resect at the same time.
Let me make one more point, and that is about postoperative imaging. Typically, there are still institutions where the post-op imaging is not necessarily done, and then patients go on to treatment, and it always becomes a bit of a challenge to interpret the later images because you don't know what was residual and what was not. The timing of that seems to be also important. In MD Anderson, where I work, we tend to do that within 48 hours of surgery, as early as possible. But beyond 72 hours or 96 hours, there is a concern that the inflammation following surgery might cause changes in the imaging that may then make it subsequently difficult to interpret. So I just wanted to make that point. The other thing maybe our neurosurgical colleagues can address is how much is control of bleeding intraoperatively and leaving a clean cavity at the end of the surgery, feasible and important in terms of subsequent things that happen to the patients.
I have one more question from the panel that I would like Dr. Kirpetra, I can ask her again. What if the location of the lesion is not involving the cortex and it is more subcortical, deep, would your strategy change in any way? Would you do it differently? Would you be worried about the white track fibers, or these things will be in your mind, or you will have the same plan as for this kind of fish?
So normally we do very prolonged preparation before surgery. So we go through the tractography, through the navigation pictures. We have the navigation of BrainLab, and we try to fix the tumor in relation with the tractography before surgery. Surgery depends of all these examinations. But normally we follow this scheme, what they told you before. And for gliomas, I think the only one what we use here in a standard method is, in addition to this, what's in another countries is using is 5LL. And I think all the other things, it's the same, like the standard what's also, for example, in the United States.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'd like to jump in. I think even if it were more subcortical and didn't come right up to the cortical surface, I think, you know, all the same things would certainly apply. Imaging and DTI tractography. And then just to answer Dr. Pudavani's question about hemostasis, I do think that it is important to maintain hemostasis and try not to leave a big hematoma in the cavity after surgery, for a couple reasons. One is, you could get post-op swelling and complications and neurologic complications due to that, but also for post-op radiation planning, because it's really hard to, if there's a lot of extra stuff that's difficult to differentiate what's residual and what's not. That does complicate, the postoperative radiation.
Okay, so if we have a patient, like if this gentleman was 63 years old, and what if we are going to have a patient, let's say 73 or 75, would your approach or would change for that patient?
I think, not exactly. I don't think the age alone is the important factor. Although certainly, if they're, I guess what we would call like the supra or extra elderly, like over 80, you might change your post slightly. But I think really, there's pretty good evidence that suggests that although the older you are, you may not get the same kind of survival with maximal treatment. There's still certainly a benefit compared to not treating maximally. So I think really for him, for an older person, I think what's going to limit your resection is your ability to do functional mapping. And even if they're very old, if they can tolerate an awake craniotomy with mapping, then I'd still go for it.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Liu, you would like to add something in terms of age particularly?
Yeah, I don't think the issue is really chronological age. It's really, performance status, functional status, as well as medical condition and how the patient can tolerate a long surgery and functional mapping and intraoperative language mapping. So I would agree with Dr. Lee.
Okay, thank you. So Dr. Wiene, would you like to add something, or we can move to the next case?
I'd like to add that after that has been achieved, maximum safe resection, obviously in a patient in his 60s, the standard of care here would be to proceed to the Stupp regimen with chemoradiation followed by Temodar for 6 months. That's what we use. And or go into clinical trials that may be appropriate for a patient like this, depending on the functional status post-surgery. I just want to emphasize the need for that post-operative imaging within a certain period of time so that we don't lose that window and have imaging confusion later when you try to assess response to therapy down the road when chemo and radiation has been provided. So, and obviously molecular marker testing is huge in these patients. So to do those kinds of things fairly quickly after surgery so that while decision-making comes up, that those decisions can be made based on what we understand of the, at least the basic molecular markers that I think are now being performed worldwide.
So may I have a question? I wanted to ask how long it takes if you guys in the United States, you have the molecular fingerprint of the tumor with IDH and with MGMT status.
I'm not sure how we can ask this question. I cannot see a question, sir. Can you?
So Dr. Charlampak is actually talking. She just asked the question about the molecular markers.
Yes, okay. So how long after the surgery you it takes to get the full diagnosis? Okay.
So I can start with that to say that while the pathology report, the phenotypic pathology reports being organized, they often do the IDH R132H staining. Mm-hmm. So you can get a readout on that. But as you know, about 20% of IDH mutant tumors do not show up on immunohistochemistry. So we send off sequencing on all of these cases. It takes about 2 weeks from the time the tissue is received for us to get the molecular markers back. We also have a panel of genes that we have included, about 146 genes or so, but there are various panels that go up to 600 genes. Okay. That can provide additional input. But fundamentally, we would have MGMT promoter methylation, IDH status, and then not uncommonly EGFR, PTEN, AKT, those PI3 kinase and TERT promoter mutation as at least a minimum panel that we would get.
So just going through the second case real quick. So 33-year-old right-handed male with right-sided secondary generalized tumor for 1 year. On examination, there were no neurological deficits. And pre-op MRI showed left frontal non-contrast enhancing lesion. Can we move to the next slide, please? Okay, so we have the T2 here. You can see the lesion in the left frontal area, and it was extending to the temporal lobe also. Next, please.
A slight enhancement there, right? Okay, next.
Yes, sir. So there was slight enhancement in the T1 post-contrast. So,
flare coronal, next. You can quickly go through this. Okay, so surgery was done.
Yeah. So there was neuronavigation guided left frontal away craniotomy, maximum safe resection. Frozen showed low grade glial neoplasm, and the histopathology came as oligo grade 2. So next, please, there are post-op scans also.
Okay, so we wanted to actually discuss before we got to this that what were the thoughts across the world. So can we go back to the previous slide, please, where we are just showing go back again, and we can go 3 slides back, please. Okay, yeah, we can stop here. So the question is, what will be recommendation, from, let's say, Linda, what would you think about it? And what would Ignatius think about it? What would Cleo think about it? So I will just ask, Cleo first, what are your thoughts about it? What do you recommend?
So when you see this pictures very carefully, it's a disastrous tumor. So it means that it's full in eloquent areas. It's in the near of the speech area. It goes in the brains, in the beginning of the brainstem. It goes in front. I think a post-total resection is here not possible. we would go for extent detection, but under neural navigation, under full processing, it seems from the preoperative MRI scans that you don't have so many contrast enhancement here. So we would try the DOLAN, we would try the 5-ALA, but I don't think that you will have a very good response here in this case. And also the tractography before. An awake surgery, I don't think that it brings more benefits because you cannot go in those high eloquent areas and take the tumor off, especially if the patient has no serious problems before surgery. And then we would recommend after histology to see if we can eradicate or...
Great, thank you. Thank you. So, Ian, what are your thoughts about it, Ian from Henry Ford, with so, the high stuff, in Michigan, right?
Yeah, so I agree fully with Dr. Charles and Paki was saying. I guess the one caveat to that would be, knowing that this is an oligodendric glioma, we have some knowledge that oligodendric gliomas perhaps do not fluoresce as avidly as other types of glioma, as astrocytomas do. So I think this is probably one, also anticipating a largely low-grade tumor that we would probably rely more on intraoperative MRI rather than fluorescence. I think the problem with this lesion, as Dr. Chalampaki was saying, is that is the extent of the lesion. It's the really dangerous part of this lesion is the fact that it involves not only the insula, but also the anterior perforated substance, which I think actually will ultimately necessitate a subtotal resection. So I think for this, I would certainly do it awake if the patient can tolerate it. And I would definitely focus on trying to get a gross total resection of the contrast enhancing portion at least. And then whatever the non-enhancing lesion, whatever we could safely do with the functional mapping that would allow us to do. I do have some doubts as to the pathology. The presence of enhancement there would make me think that this is probably more likely to be an anaplastic lesion rather than low grade. And so for the purposes of the biopsies, for what I would give to the pathologist, I would especially focus in on that contrast enhancing portion in order to provide as accurate a pathological diagnosis as possible.
Right, great, yes, thank you. So Mike, there's a message over here that Ignatius is as an audience. He was a panelist. I don't know if you can somehow send him an invite to join here. Mobile is actually sending a message. And for some reason, Ian was not heard by some of the audience. Okay, so yeah, it makes sense, Ian, what you said. Vinay, Dr. Kudabali is an oncologist in MD Anderson. He looks at things in a different way, probably more cerebral way than the researchers look at things. So Vinay, what are your thoughts about this slight enhancement in here? Would you seek a single biopsy or would you recommend a good chunk of the tissue removed?
Yeah, so typically when we see tumors like this, in MD Anderson, our neurosurgical colleagues often attempt to get enough tissue for molecular diagnosis to be accurate, which I think is very important here. And as was mentioned, enhancing areas like that, which might happen in low-grade tumors and don't necessarily always mean something high-grade, should be sampled, I think, because that might be the highest yield in terms of the correct diagnosis. So there are some nuances to this whole case here. The patient is less than 40 years of age. And as you are aware, putting this patient into a high risk versus low risk category depends on the extent of resection. So maximum safe resection, quote unquote, gross total resection as defined by the neurosurgeon was what was used in RTOG 9802 to define the lower risk group. In this case, I suspect that may not be necessarily possible because of the nature and the location of the tumor there, the side of the tumor. So the next thing that's really important, I think, is to understand the molecular makeup of this tumor, because that might define prognosis in all kinds of ways, even if a surgical maximum resection is not attainable. So I would ask our neurosurgical colleagues to get me as much tissue as possible, including a separate biopsy of the enhancing area, so that the pathologist can give us an accurate diagnosis. And the reason I would say that is, there's a general sense that if it is an oligodendroglioma, whether it is grade 2 or grade 3, that seems to not matter as much in the setting of adjuvant treatment that we give now. So if this patient has residual disease more than 1 centimeter, the tumor is about 3 or 4 centimeters, I think, in size, which is generally considered to be one of the unfavorable prognostic factors. But almost certainly this patient, if it is a true oligo, would have 1p19q co-deletion that would allow providing radiation followed by chemotherapy that, as you know, has provided excellent survival in these patients, double the survival in that subset particularly. Two other points I wanted to make in histology is that there are micro deletions in the 1p and 19q areas that the probes may fail to attach, but that doesn't always mean true co-deletion, because you're talking about whole chromosome losses that define an oligodendroglioma. So you've had cases where the probes fail to bind, and then subsequent next generation sequencing showed that there were micro deletions in these chromosomes, and it was not a true whole chromosome alarm loss. And those patients did not do as well as you would suspect with a grade 2 oligodendroglioma. So to do a good thorough study of the molecular makeup and make sure that you get that information. Of course, IDH mutation almost always happens in these patients and is a good prognostic marker. In general, if this turns out to be a grade 2 oligodendroglioma with none of the other unfavorable marker status, you would expect with standard treatment of radiation followed by chemotherapy we typically use PCV. In some cases, we may go to temozolomide. That is being defined with the CODEL study that's ongoing, and we hope to get results from that. But that, I think, may perhaps complement the surgical approach, even if it is not satisfactory, to give the patient the best prognosis.
So you would prefer PCV over temozolomide, at least in this case, given that molecular finding, right?
So I think the data that exists in a large randomized study is for PCV. And these two are not equivalent treatments. Temozolomide is a monofunctional alkylator that causes methylation or alkylation and DNA repair based on the presence of additional things like DNA repair enzymes being active. Whereas CCNU and procarbazine, etc., CCNU is a bifunctional alkylator, causes cross-linking and causes a somewhat different method of cell kill. So just because they're alkylators, I would not switch them. If the patient has comorbidities that might be limiting in terms of using CCNU, I think that's certainly a consideration. I don't know we have the right answer yet, but I would wait for the CODEL study, which is now accruing steadily, and hopefully we'll get some preliminary results in the next 2 years or so that might guide us better.
So Linda, if I can ask you a question. Linda, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so Linda, I mean, we heard from people from Europe and, from Michigan and Texas. But then what about, and I'm unfortunately, Ignatius will join us and Jin Song from China is not here. But, what about those places where we don't have rectography, we don't have awake craniotomy set up, there are many places. We don't have those molecular biology labs to understand the molecular biology. What would you recommend to do in this kind of case?
Well, I guess if possible.
So go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead, please.
I guess if possible, probably, refer to an institution that has those things for optimization of patient outcomes. But I guess if not possible, I still, for this patient, I think optimally you do want to get, gross maximal resection. I agree with what everybody has said about the nuances of this particular case. You know, in a 33-year-old with a non-enhancing tumor, most likely this is an IDH1 mutated tumor. And the additional, you know, enhancement suggests that this is probably perhaps a low-grade tumor transitioning to a grade 2 transitioning to a grade 3. So if you are going to do surgery, I think optimally you want to get the most diagnostic sample. So even if you don't have all the, tools for awake mapping, tractography, you know, everything we talked about before, I think, you know, getting a good chunk of tumor tissue for diagnosis, as Dr. Puttavalli said, is important. You know, at UCLA, we also, you know, for these kind of very diffuse, low-grade tumors, we also do amino acid PET scans. So we use dopamine, but, you know, there's FET-PET and other types of PET tracers that specifically are used for defining kind of areas of highest yield when we do these biopsies, because in these very diffuse areas or diffuse tumors, if you're going to do surgery, you really want to go in there with the goal of getting the most diagnostic sample. But I guess in answer to your question, if you don't have all those tools, I would not necessarily advocate just for a needle biopsy. I would actually say do an open biopsy and get a good chunk of tumor tissue.
Okay. So that sounds like a wise recommendation, that if you don't have enough technology, if you don't have enough molecular biology support, you at least get a big chunk to get a histopathological diagnosis of grade 2 versus grade 3. So Mike, can we go ahead, move a few slides ahead? So this patient underwent surgery, awake craniotomy. Now, what I have found in Pakistan, awake craniotomy is no extra cost. Mike, can you move the slide, please? Yeah. Now, keep on going. Keep on going. More. Yeah. Okay. So, go back. Go back. The previous slide, please. Where it says T2, post-op, 20. Okay, there we go. So this actually awake, no, okay. So the awake craniotomy, is not really expensive and easy to set up. If we do it in a very elaborate way, it becomes difficult. Now here is actually reasonably good, but if you notice that there was a post-op hemorrhage in here. So my question to Ian, that the patient did not have any symptoms, would you go in and recommend the surgeon to remove this clot? I think he had one seizure, right, Asan? Was it? That's how we got the MRI done?
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Yes, sir. So Ian, what would you recommend?
You can see the clot right on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, although it's not pretty to look at, I mean, as long as the patient's not having symptoms from it, then I wouldn't go back after it.
Okay. The patient did well. Keep on going, and we were following it on a routine MRI 3 months. Can we move forward, Mike?
I wonder if Dr. Liao has any comments about the degree of hemorrhage that we are seeing here and whether an intervention is.
Yeah, I would say this is, you know, quite a bit of hemorrhage. Oligodendrogliomas do tend to be more hemorrhagic than astrocytomas. And I think it would really kind of depend on, if the patient has symptoms or not. Frankly, I'd be surprised that he doesn't have at least some language symptoms given the location of the bleed and the size of the hematoma. But if I can't tell, is this a post, like a 3 month post op scan or an immediate post op, the one you're showing?
I think this is probably within a few weeks because there was a big hematoma there. Right. Okay, so Mike, can you move forward, please? So the question that I want to ask this panel and for the audience to think about is that there was resolution of this hematoma over time. Mike, can you move forward, please?
I think in these scans, there was no recurrence. The disease was static. And when we go to the February and 2021, there was some kind of hyperintensity in the superior anterior margin of the resection cavity, but no uptake in the contrast. But when recently in May this month, there is small contrast enhancement, the same nodule that was hyper intense in February. Yes, Mike, you can continue to move. Here you can see in the coronal one, if you go some kind of hyper intensity. Next one. We couldn't see any contrast enhancement in February scans, but there is some in the May. Next one, please. Okay. Next. Next. So I just want to take the panel to the main slide where you can see that. Yes, next one. Next one. Okay, yeah, just 1 minute. So if you can see, you know, that hyper intensity, and this is was like very recent in the month of, like, I would say last week, 2 weeks back. So you can see that hyper intense area here. And next one, please. Yeah, that's it. Just wait here, please. Sorry, sir, I was just going through the images so that, you know, this is the last, you know, in the May, and then we can see some contrast enhancement.
So, Hassan, if I might jump in.
Yes, sir, please.
Yeah, so I think if this were a true grade 2 oligodendroglioma, which, as you know, typically grows over many, many years, it's a little unusual for us to see progression with enhancement within, I think, less than a year of surgery and, you know, recovery from those procedures. So I think it emphasizes the issue of what is the histology of this tumor, and of course, what is the nature of this enhancement that we are seeing here. Since no other treatment has been given, it is difficult to attribute this to radiation effects or chemo effects, etc. I mean, there's only been surgery so far that I understand. So in the first instance, I would certainly make sure that if the local pathology is not specialized in terms of neuropathology, that you always send it out to a expert neuropathologist for diagnosis. Low-grade gliomas are notoriously difficult to diagnose in the sense that there has been lots of discordance between even specialists in diagnosing it just by phenotypic morphology method of diagnosis. So getting molecular markers, making sure that this is indeed a grade 2 oligo and that it does not have any adverse prognostic factors would be crucial in terms of anticipating the behavior. So if this turns out to have no 1p19q co-deletion, even if it morphologically has some appearance of oligodendroglioma, I would be worried that this is actually an astrocytoma looking like an oligo, and that is progressing, you know, faster than you would expect in such a patient. But if it was 1p19q co-deleted and there are no other adverse molecular factors, then, you know, such changes I might tend to watch rather than treat, because the decision to treat is usually made, you know, typically after surgery and recovery from surgery. And there are instances where patients are observed and not treated at that time. And then later on, let's say a year later, the question comes up as to if you, you know, sometimes I see a patient that's been managed in the community for a year without any additional adjuvant treatment. So when they come to me, I have to make a decision on whether I can apply the same data that I get in the large studies where the treatment was given immediately after surgery versus doing that 1 year later, whether I can truly depend on that information. However, we know that these patients do well from radiation and chemotherapy if there is residual tumor. In this case, my understanding was there was no residual tumor after surgery, so you would have observed this patient anyway because of the young age and gross total resection. I suspect there may have been residual disease that perhaps was only seen by the MRI later. So there are those factors to consider. I would at least do another scan and see if this enhancement goes away. But if it continues to grow, then I think it calls for another sampling of that tissue to find out what's going on.
Dr. Liu, would you go for the resection, or what will be your decision in this patient?
Yeah, I would agree with Dr. Puduvalli. I mean, actually, the enhancement looks quite subtle, if this is the scan you're referring to. And, you know, because this patient did have that postoperative bleed, this could be some, you know, vascular leak, you know, of the contrast into that area. And if this was a scan within 3 months of the last surgery and the patient's asymptomatic, I would probably just get another scan, you know, in a month or two, just to see if there is, you know, true progression or not, before doing anything, because you know, as was said, I think it's unusual for a low-grade oligodendroglioma to progress within 3 months. So, and usually after surgery, there's so much shift with, especially if you take out a large tumor, we usually use like the 3 month scan as the baseline to compare subsequent scans, because these tumors usually grow slowly, and you know, you want a good baseline, especially if there's postoperative blood and, you know, other you know, T2 abnormalities. One question I did have, and I don't know if you have this information, is do you know the Ki-67 index on this tumor? Was that something you typically get, the proliferation index?
Yeah, so the Ki-67 index was low. P53 was negative, and 1P19Q co-deletion was detected in this tumor.
Okay, because if the Ki-67 index is low, it probably is more of a grade 2 or a lower grade, you know, versus a higher grade, and I wouldn't expect that it would grow so quickly at this point. But if you know, the subsequent scan in a couple months shows further progression, you know, I agree it would be worthwhile to go back in and get another biopsy and see what's changed.